This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Nomads Past and Present, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie Freeman, and my guest today is Dr. Saga Bogdaeva. Saga is a scholar of Eurasian studies, working to identify and preserve the nomadic oral and written heritage of the Great Eurasian Steppe. She received her PhD in sociology from Yale University in 2010 and currently teaches sociology and anthropology at Fordham University and CUNY College of Staten Island. Her translation of the Kalmyk epic poem Jungar was published earlier this year by University of California Press, and that's what we'll be talking about today. So thank you so much, Saga, for joining me.
For having me.
First, there are probably two pieces of our conversation today that probably need to be contextualized and clarified a bit for listeners, and those being the Kalmyk people and the poem itself that you've translated, Jungar. So if we could maybe start with the Kalmyks, could you explain just sort of, you know, in broad strokes, sort of an overview of who the Kalmyks are, where they're from, what the region of Kalmykia is?
Yes. So the history of my people is very complicated because we live in the Russian Federation, and Russia tried to write our own history. And we had our own historians. My culture is has this emphasis on the Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist law. We have all these historical roots with the Silk Road, so-called Silk Road, or I call it the Eurasian Steppe Road. And living within this constant various Russian regimes, the Russian Tsarist regime, then the Soviet regime, then Putin's regime. So our historical records that were written by our own historians were often destroyed or still are hidden in the archives in St. Petersburg and Moscow or in neighboring regions. So neighboring regions, which are neighboring Slav regions, have a lot of our museum treasures or historical letters. So we kind of know our history, whether what we have from the system of regime or by accident. So some historians find letters, right? So some people would go to the museum and by accident a letter falls on the floor and they see it. And so it's almost like having different clues and putting them together. And so now it's an exciting time because there are so many clues. So many people question the written histories by the system of power that we live in now. So and then there are so many questions, right, that can be easily challenged now by the available evidence, that I felt that I should do something. And of course, who I am to do. I always thought there are so many great scholars, but I felt like if I do something, even to change the narrative that is sort of pushed on us, that we are not educated, that we didn't have our own literature, that we didn't have our own history, that we didn't have our own language long enough, right? So we, because Moscow narrative is that Kalmyks came to the place where we live now just recently. But my own point of view is that we have this long history with the steppe. So, and it's everywhere. It's in our poetry, it's in our history, it's in our the way we dress, the way we relate to animals. This is part of our history. Steppe is who we are. We go to the, we born out of the steppe and we go to the steppe. So sometimes I get impatient, like, why Moscow tell us that we came to the, to our steppe, right? They have the right to their own woods and living in the forest, and we have our own right to our own relationship with the steppe.
Mm-hmm. And so the poem Jungar was composed in the medieval period, and you describe it as the kind of national poem, the kind of national epic poem of the Kalmyks. So what's the sort of history of the Kalmyks during the period when the poem was likely kind of created or composed? What's happening in Kalmykia around when the poem is being written?
So right away we need to kind of turn off our modern thinking and turn on the we need to switch to a different mode of thinking, right? So we need to go to medieval or earlier times, right? So don't think in your national imagination with like Mongols, Russia, China, America. So you need to forget all these signals, right? Modern signals, and that makes the epic unique, right? We can transform to this different. I don't say time because there is no time in the epic itself. You can go back was so long that at some point time is irrelevant. Same with you can fight over, oh, this is our modern land, this is your modern land. But if you push further or deeper, right, that becomes irrelevant too, because there are so many names, right? So we are called now Kalmykia before, but this name was given to us after the destruction of our Khanates, and before it was, we were called Oirats, and before the Oirats, we were... So there are so many names. So at the end, in the time of the epic, it's all about geography for the nomads. So to explain Jungar, we cannot really operate with the modern terms, right? So then... to understand the epic, we can switch the time mode. We can switch off the modern right era and go into a different dimension, and it's a spatial dimension. So you would have the mountains, you would have the steppe, you would have the animals. And so the to conceptualize that spatial interrelations or dynamic. So dynamic, you need to understand the interrelations with the animals. What kind of animals? What kind of plants and trees and mountains and rivers? They relate, right? And then relating again those kind of points of reference, you have completely unique picture of the world. So I cannot say this belong to this nation state, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say that this is the epic of my ancestors who had very deep relationship with the Eurasian steppe. And when you think about this Eurasian steppe road, right? So it's not like a territorial polity like a modern polity, right? So it's stretch, it's a road. So then you can think about a nomadic polity as a road. So it's not, it's extended and narrow, right? It can unite multiple khanates. I don't know how to explain khanates. It's a different nomadic polity, right? Let's say kingdoms, right? So along the road, you have different kingdoms. And they all stretch because their main function, right, as a people was to connect different civilizations, right? So they were between East and West, between Europe and Asia. So so they were kind of the agents of trade and cultural interactions. So they are connected with the Eurasian steppe road. And the Eurasian steppe road goes from the Altai Mountains and all the way to the Caucasus Mountains.
And so I was really struck by, when I was reading your translation, you know, I couldn't sort of help myself from kind of wanting to experience the text of the poem sort of as it was meant to be experienced originally, perhaps. And in your introduction, you describe this kind of hybrid medium of poetry, song, and performance that all kind of came together in Jhangar. So can you give a sense of what that original sort of experience of listening to and hearing Jhangar would have been like? You know, obviously it was not originally a kind of written text, it was performed orally. So where would people have heard it? Who would have performed it? Who would it have been performed for?
So the focus of the epic is building, is around building strong community. So the goal of singing the epic is to bring the nomads together. And then through, so it had many dimensions. One of them was to, or functions. One of them was to train the public minds about their history and culture. So so it's similar to what we watch now on Netflix, right? And it's a strong tool to spread these exciting stories and transmit those stories to a wide population. So so it would be so and of course it was polished through such kind of collective entertainment, right? So the audience would decide which poem was polished best, right? So it's almost like today, right? In the entertainment industry, the audience decide are they watching or not, right? So then the singers were either popular among the people, right? And then they became famous. They became the stars of Jhangar. And the inside the poem, the poems were so long, you could sing them, you could entertain the guests, the audience for whole nights, right? And we can read in one of the chapters how they did it. So inside the poems, you have it made of poetic blocks. So so for example, there is a certain certain poems, and these poems are blessings. So in people would get together and they become and they would recite those blessings. For example, if you have a beautiful red shirt, right, people would make a poem of blessing for your beautiful red shirt, right? If somebody wears silver earrings, it'll be a blessing for that silver earrings. Or you have a beautiful horse, it'll be a blessing for that horse. And so it was almost like a competition in all these gatherings. So clearly, there were a lot of gatherings and parties and drinking and merrymaking, and they were so the this poetic tradition was a part of those of that collective enjoyment.
You know, so we tend to assume that nomadic cultures only produce oral forms of literature. I think that's a kind of frequent trope. And so Jungar seems to be an example of that. But then you write in your introduction to the epic that the Kalmuk Khanate was highly literate, and laws mandating, you know, literacy and sort of high levels of education were sort of strictly enforced. So then why do you think that this, you know, oral epic poem was produced? What was the kind of utility of that in a nomadic context when, you know, if we can assume that a lot of people, probably more people than we would otherwise imagine, were actually literate, why was this kind of oral form of literary production so kind of highly prized and practiced?
So there are many genres and types of literature, history. So it doesn't need to be only orally transmitted, right? So it can be written documents, written materials. For the Kalmyk nomads, it was important to have many types of transmission as possible, right? Mm-hmm. So you have written literature on birch barks,
mm-hmm.
Written literature on paper, any types of like physical materials, right? You have literature on the stones in the middle of the Eurasian, or along the Eurasian steppe road, right? And you also have the orally transmitted, memorized type of literature. So so the people, because they were nomads and they traveled, they went through many persecutions, right? So the Soviets were not the first, and they will be not the last, right? So you develop different ways of preserving your culture.
Mm.
So all paper literature is burnt and destroyed. You have the rock literature. If the rock literature are not allowed, then you have something memorized by heart,
mm.
right? So and it's a beautiful way of resistance. So how to manage to preserve something that is constantly being destroyed, right? And so you have one generation, and the regime would try to destroy everything and tell, oh, you are not educated, you don't have literature, because we burnt your books, right? and then the next generation would hear the same, the third generation would hear the same. So at some point, the people think, yes, we do not have literature. Yes, we are uneducated, and therefore we shouldn't even think about our own qualities, right? Because any treasures of our own, right? And but the community developed this rebellious memories and the oral narratives, right? And then they would sing those songs, and so you would have, I don't know, what, 70 years or 70, 80 years of the Soviet Union, and then you would have more of Putin's strange regime, right? And before even the Tsarist regime. And it's a such a strong, powerful survival technique. On the one hand, they tell you, you are illiterate, you don't have that literature, you are a barbaric nation that only knows how to destroy, right? And then you hear the stories of not the destruction, but literature treasure, right? And you see through this the treasures that can be matched with the treasures of the Metropolitan Museum, right? And so you start to question, and then you have strong hope that that is not the story that we want to know for ourselves. So that's why you have different ways of resistance. The type of literature is destroyed, you have the other, right? And so I wanted to show that outside of this Soviet, post-Soviet Russia, that there are so many types of literature that maybe these types of literature don't fit in what we think with our modern mode of investigation. But if we explore this type of literature, we will realize that the essence of what these nomads wanted to pass to the future generation is more important than what kind of mode of transmission, right? So yes, it's not on the paper, right? Yes, it's not on the white paper. Yes, it's not with the black ink, right? But the information, the quality of what they were transmitting is so deep, right? So that it's not with the black ink or on the white paper, right? If we should consider that the ink and the white paper was taken away and we live inside the prison.
So along those lines, can you talk a little bit about your sort of role and responsibility as a translator and sort of how you see your responsibility in terms of sort of making this work accessible to the English-speaking public, and maybe also any kind of challenges that you encountered in translation? You know, are there certain terms or concepts or just sort of ways that the poem is structured that you had to kind of wrestle with how to make those kind of understandable to a modern Western English-speaking audience?
I think the is how do we train ourselves to switch off the modern thinking, ourselves to explore something different, right? Because it's sometimes, even I am prejudiced, right? It took me so many years to get to this point. I was like, why should I do that? If nobody's going to read this type of literature, it will be hard to convince people to read this type of literature. But I think the world is ready, because in the past, for me to say the Soviet regime, Putin's regime, Russian regime did this to my people's literature, so outside Russia, people would not believe, right? Because it took Ukraine and the war in Ukraine to understand the level of violence, right? And the might of that regime to control every voice within its territory, right? So now if I say, you think we don't have literature because the regime didn't allow us to show and present and demonstrate that literature, right? So now people would be more open to trust. Yes, let me read your proposal. Let me read that poetry. Let's discuss it on the post. Right? So people realize that what is given to us outside of Russia, Eurasia, maybe it's not the only world that exists inside the borders, right? So there are many more interesting cultures, many more interesting voices that can that can share this beauty of literature, stories, their own stories.
So what do you think is the kind of contemporary relevance or significance of Dzungar for Kalmyks today? Is there one, you know, are people sort of still aware of it?
So another challenge, and that challenge can be connected to your question, is I didn't know where to start, right? Like where I start to talk about this rich Kalmyk literature, right? If people even don't know who are the Kalmyks, right? So the epic, the heroic epic Dzungar is the foundation of any type of literature. So all poets, all, I don't know, modern novelists of Kalmykia, right? They, it's almost like learning the alphabet. This is what the epic absorbed all the wise statements for many generations. Okay? So you can, every word is polished. So the language is very effective language. So in one sentence, you can have a story, right? And so each word has a meaning of that you need, you can write a dissertation just on one keyword, right? So there are different types of literature. There are letters, communications between the kings, right? There are poetry of fathers to their lost children, or a poem of father's love to his daughter, right? And or a mother's song to her son. So it's yeah, or more modern poetry, for example, by Kubultinov when he was in the prison, in the Soviet prison, right? It's what the people themselves decided this is their national literature, this is their national voice, right, of their people. So the epic is only the foundational, the introduction into the history of the people, into the history of literature, the comic poems.
Well, thank you so much for coming on to talk to me about the comics, comic history, poetry, and literary production. This has been really interesting. I really appreciated just the fact that this translation exists and is making this work more accessible to a wider audience. So thank you for doing the work of translating it. And I really recommend Saga's translation of Jangar. For all listeners who might be interested in Central Eurasian history, poetry, all of the above. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.